Welcome everyone to the Friends That Carry On podcast, where we dive deeper into our trips, unpack tips, and everything in between. Now sit back, relax, and get ready to go on a trip with your favorite group of friends.
Hello, and welcome to this week's podcast of Friends That Carry On. We are a group of friends who like to travel the world and try to create FOMO amongst ourselves and others. And we try to live by our motto of life don't suck. Today in the Friends That Carry On studio, we have Eric Fargo, Brian Romine, Tony Price, and myself, Jim Scott. And today we have a special treat for you listeners. We have a writer, novelist, journalist from Canada, an American writer who's traveled the world and also happens to be the grandson of Ernest Hemingway. So give a big Friends That Carry On welcome to John Hemingway.
Woo!
Hello, John.
Welcome, John.
I can hear them clapping there in the virtual universe. Oh,
well, we were thinking about it. Should we clap? No, what should we do? So I just did woo-hoo.
It's produced. We can always, you know, like, well,
we can add that after
we'll the clapping
after.
In.
There'll be a lot of clapping in the background.
Or you could have canned laughter, too.
Right. Yeah. Hit that button.
We haven't gotten that far yet. But.
Well, yeah. So,
well, it's a pleasure to be here. Well, actually, in my bedroom, but to be on the air with you guys.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. And I'm sure you've met a billion people, but I mentioned to you when we were messaging back and forth, we met you on our first trip to Fiesta in Pamplona in 2013.
So 2013, my God, yeah. That was a while back.
Yeah. I think Michael, your son?
Michael was there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was,
yeah.
He was just getting started in photography.
Yeah, something. Right?
Uh-huh.
Right. Okay. Yeah, so it was pretty interesting. So it was a good trip for us. So.
Well, it was a great trip for us. Plus, the reason we were there is our one friend, Jim Reed, who sometimes joins us on these podcasts, is a literature professor in California. And your grandfather is one of his favorite authors. So he decided to, even though he's older and like all of us out of shape and so forth, he decided to run with the bulls was his thing to do for his 50th. And it started as a lark and a joke. And then like 10, 11 of us signed up to do it. So he had to do it. So we wandered
there. So you all
there.
Ran with the bulls.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, we've been back numerous times now. And we'll talk about your novel here in a little bit. The characters and everything from Bacchanalia really, really ring true to us. But anyway, it was really special for him to get to meet you and your son, Michael, on that trip because of the way he feels about your grandfather, Ernest.
Yeah, it was kind of a surprise for him.
Well, Michael, he's been there 5 times. Mm-hmm. And speaking of my book, he designed the cover.
Oh,
awesome. The photograph in that was taken by Jim Hollander. You guys may have met. He's an American Israeli photographer, lives in Tel Aviv. And I asked him for some pictures, and so he sent me a selection. And there was that one there with a girl standing, sitting on the shoulders of her boyfriend there, just right at the moment of the chupinazo, you know, when everything goes crazy in the town hall. And Mike took that, and then he had a sort of a picture of me from behind. So that's my profile from behind there. And then he just put a Penuelo on it and bang. I mean, he just nailed it in 20 minutes.
Right.
No, really.
That's great. I was wondering if that was your silhouette there as the main person.
Yeah,
there.
That's mine. And Michael, it's just an incredible cover, really. I'm just so pleased with that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great picture.
Yeah. Agreed.
That great picture. Well, speaking of the novel, what was your inspiration, you know, just to get that one started? I mean, there's obviously a lot of symmetry between your family name in the Fiesta, but what made you decide to write about it?
You know, for years, people have been saying to me, hey, John, you know, you go to the Fiesta and everything. Why don't you write your own version of it? And I said, no way. That's a kiss of death.
Right.
You know? you don't mess with the man, you know, that sort of stuff. And no, I mean, I'm a great admirer of my grandfather's writing and everything. Then, you know, I was working on a collection of short stories and everything, and I said, you know, screw this, it's going to take forever, because short stories are a lot harder to write than novels. You know, they're like, I don't know, works of art in a sense. Everything has to fit, everything has to be conscious of the space you have and everything. So it's, and I said, well, okay, let's try writing something on the Fiesta. Because I'd written 2 short stories on the Fiesta, And they gave me some ideas, and so I decided to go with that. And I started it basically with how I met Christina, my wife, you know, just by chance. Although he wasn't a psychiatrist, he's a lawyer. Okay. the Russian friend, that is.
Right.
Who had been trying to sort of meet me for 2 years. And the year before, we had almost hooked up, but didn't. And then that year, he just brought along, you know, a couple of his friends, as I described there. And, of course, in reality, Mike was with me. Okay. Mm-hmm. This was the year 2014, the year after we met, mm-hmm. The year I met you guys. And then it went from there, and characters got added along the way, and probably recognized some of them, certainly.
Yeah, Jim and I were talking, you know, having been there several times now, mm-hmm. It was really kind of like a walk down memory lane for a lot of it. Not all of it. I mean, some of the there's some parts.
Yeah.
That, yeah, not all of it. But.
Yeah, we could take part in a few of those things. But,
but you know, talk about Bar Chaco and the Windsor and, you know, walking down Mercaderes and, you know, just all the references was, it really is kind of like a memory lane.
Yeah, there are a lot of classic sort of, you know, expat places that I talk about, and I also talk about the expat parties, you know, the vodka party, mm-hmm. you know, hosted by the International Gutter Club. Mm-hmm. You know, that is one of the wickedest parties because they have a last man standing, you know. And
have you ever been that
first person who basically passes out wins the contest? I think or something like that.
Have you ever been a winner?
No. But I have. At times, had to get out of there because I thought this, you know, this orange shit here is not going to be the end of you, John. Well.
So, John, do you make a point to try to get to the festival every year?
Well, in a couple of years, I haven't been able to. In 2017 and 2018, I was having problems getting a visa for Christina, who's Russian. And finally, last year, we figured out the system. This year we thought we'd figured it out too, but now they've got this coronavirus thing and they shut down their consulate here. You know, just, you know, we'd made an appointment and everything. All appointments have been canceled. So I don't really know what the hell's going to go on this year, what they're going to do with it. I would imagine that they'll try in some way because that brings in, I've heard, something like a third of what they earn in 1 year.
Right. Like, I'm sure.
I can imagine. Yeah.
In those 9 days, you know. I mean,
in July, it's a bit off, so it's a ways off. But you have to plan so far ahead.
So there's so
the
many
problem
people
is,
there.
It's not a problem for me. You know, I've got a Canadian passport, an American passport. But she only has a Russian passport, so she needs a visa. Mm-hmm. And that takes time with these people, you know. And I think, well... If they don't open it up again in April or something like that, you know, I don't know what the hell's going to happen, but we'll see.
Well, hopefully we'll get to see you there.
Right.
We're going to try to, I was supposed to be in France for the entire month of July, and I'm not sure what that's going to be like now. So.
Oh yeah. Look, this is virus and it does, you know, act pretty much like I would imagine like the flus do in the sense that, you know, when the temperature gets, you know, plus 30 degrees centigrade, the virus pretty much becomes inactive, you know, can't function.
Right. Well, let's hope so. Let's hope it's sooner and later.
I agree.
Let's hope for a hot summer.
everything is so messed up these days. I'm thinking about it. Well, my God, I thought Trump was going to shut down domestic air travel at one point, you know, today. But no, he didn't do that.
So. Chaos is the new normal.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, pretty much.
So we're getting back to the novel, though. So just out of curiosity, I know, mm-hmm. that, like you said, the names have been changed to protect the innocent. But I think, you know, having run in similar circles over there, we definitely picked up on some of the, what do you want to say, characteristics
of a few of the characters.
A few of the people. So,
well, you know, I mean, they're a composite.
Right, okay. Sure.
There are characters there who I'm sure you guys recognize, but at other times, I think I've more or less rendered them unrecognizable, well, I can't say anything because I've already put a disclaimer in the book.
Sure. So
I don't think it's sued, sure.
We're not going to say who we think it is.
We're going to say we screw John Hemingway. Yeah.
We think we have an idea on Hector.
You might.
Yeah. I mean, he obviously is still alive. But so we think him. And then now we definitely know this is a composite, but Ian definitely reminds us of somebody who's older now, but who would have fit the bill a number of years ago.
Yeah.
Wow. I really want to read
that
this
Ian
now.
There. Yeah. He's probably would have been that way in his younger days, I guess. Right. You know, but in the book, Ian is Ian.
Sure. Oh, sure. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Hector is Hector.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a great read. So
I haven't had a chance to read this. Is this, John, does this take place over the course of just 1 year or several years?
No, it starts and pretty much ends with Fiesta, okay? 1 year. It starts in the Chipinazo, okay? You know, when they let off the rocket, in the city hall, and everyone goes crazy on the 6th of July at noon. And it ends maybe 2 or 3 days after, okay, in Madrid, where two of the characters in the book go to sort of, basically wind down, just to chill, try to digest everything that has happened, in those 9 days. And, they go, they see the museums, they visit a few locales, that sort of thing, and then it ends at a restaurant, okay?
Take a vacation from their vacation.
You've been there, so you know what it's like. Yeah. You really need, I remember Rick Muzica, telling me, I've got a detox after this.
I was just going to say, sounds like rehab.
Well, and I thought it was interesting because we've done the same thing, taking a day to go up to San Sebastian just to chill out, and
the weirdest thing is when you leave, you get in a cab, and all of a sudden you're climbing down from that hill, going towards maybe the train station, and you see that the world is still the world.
Yeah. Yeah, because when you're in the plaza clean, there.
The people are not dressed in red and white. It's weird.
It takes a while to get used to that again.
Mm-mm.
It does, and it does take a rest. I mean, that's hard on the body.
I will say though that the day up to San Sebastian is a good break. Mm-hmm. That is a good respite.
Oh yeah, that was an excellent break. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the book, I incorporate that.
Yeah, it was awesome.
No, it was real familiar to me. That's one of the things I liked about the book. It was an easy read and flowed nicely. And having been there, I don't know, 4 or 5 times now, it really did feel comfortable. So it made it for a quick read too. I wanted to get back to it because I attached to some of the characters or felt like I knew them, and made for a nice read, a nice book.
Yeah. Hey, John, I have a question. Where can our listeners find the book or listen to the book? Available?
There's only one place, basically. Well, where most people can get it. I mean, you can find it at, for instance, the Hemingway Rum Distillery in Key West, and also at the Hemingway Pfeiffer House and Museum in Piggott, Arkansas. Those are two places that sell it. I'm an indie author, not because I want to be, but because my agent and 20 other agents said, go take a hike. It was just way too much for these people. I was just like pushing too many buttons. I triggered them. I don't know. They wanted safe spaces. Who knows? And so I went to Amazon and self-published. So you're going to find it on Amazon.com.
Excellent.
Okay.
Okay.
Look up John Hemingway, Bacchanalia, Pamplona Story, and you can get it in paperback or in ebook.
Oh, great.
Now, eventually, as my career progresses, someone might sort of say, hey, we should do a hardcover version of that book that no one wanted to publish back in the day because it was pornographic or something. I don't know. eventually, yeah. Right now, all you got is paperback and ebook.
And who's the narrator on the ebook? Or is it that's not a
okay?
That's
just
that's reading ebook. Okay, not
you have an audio Kindle. Version, okay. John.
You know, you download it onto your gotcha. E-reader, yeah. So to speak.
No. We have a copy of it actually sitting here, so it'll be on the video. Yeah, yeah. So we'll put it up and make some references to it up on the podcast website as well. So,
how long did you work on this book, John?
Pretty much a year, although, you know, I thought that I had finished it in the summer, but then it wasn't finished, and I had to do another, basically, three different revisions of it, going over it, and over it, and over it, and over it, and paring it down, and making it the kind of smooth read that you see there. Also, in the beginning, I had a different idea. It was more sort of a happy ending, and then my wife didn't really like that, so I said, okay, do you want reality, or do you want... fairy tale. She goes, reality. So I went with reality.
Ah. You know?
Well, reality in the sense of life being nasty sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, speaking of that, so you just got back from Key West. You were down at the distillery, right, for a signing to get that started?
Yeah, basically, I call that the launch of the book, okay? It's not really a national launch because the book, I may have sold perhaps 500 copies since November or something like that. All together. So this is why I'm working now with another editor who Thomas Dunn, and he really liked Bacchanalia, and he's liking the stuff that I'm writing on Milan. And I've also got in mind another book which would take place on both sides of the Florida Straits in Miami and in Havana. And I'd written a couple of short stories on that. One in particular that he really liked. And so we're talking about that too. So potentially another two books coming out. And it's kind of a new period for me. I'm writing a lot more. And it's a good period. Definitely.
Great. That's awesome.
Yeah, that is great. I wanted to ask you too. We were talking about, obviously, we're travel people. You know, and Fiesta is one of the many places we've been. So I know you've been around the globe quite a bit as well. So in your travels, where's some of your favorite places to visit?
Well, I have to say that I was fascinated by Havana. Okay, Havana has this decadence about it. You know, I mean, yes, it is a totalitarian state. There is no rule of law per se. You know, that's what they decide. Yeah. And at the same time, the people are extremely vital. The population is very young, well-educated. The architecture of Havana is just amazing. I mean, even though some of the buildings are crumbling, it just gives you an idea of the kind of splendor that place must have been, you know, right at the time of the revolution or soon thereafter. Very interesting culture. And... Well worth visiting if you get the chance. I know it's difficult for Americans now because of Trump.
I hear a book in the future about Havana.
Yeah. Right? I spent a lot of time in Italy, and I'm really sorry to see what's happening to them. China and Italy both have a rather large population of elderly, and this virus is pretty much tailor-made to wipe out the elderly. You know, you get to 70-75 and you are on the bullseye basically for this virus. And also both of those countries have the highest pollution levels of their cities that have particulate matter levels which just are off the charts, you know. And I remember that back in the day when I was there, and I would go out cycling with my bike, which I'm actually looking at right now. It's this, you know, handmade racing bike. And I would have to clean it off because there'd be these little bits of grit all over it, you know. And that was just from the air going through it.
And this was Italy you were in?
And I thought, John, and I thought, this shit's in your lung, John. That's in your lungs right now. And I would always get, you know, flus there and stuff like that. Whereas beforehand, when I'd gone to university in Los Angeles, which, yes, has air pollution, but it's just nothing like what you have in Lombardia and northern Italy. I never got flus Never once. And there I was getting all the time, you know. So it doesn't surprise me what's going on there, unfortunately. Yeah.
This is Italy's Eric. Mm-hmm. I've been to Milan, and I've also been to – you ever been just north of there, Bergamo, or is it Bergamo? How do you pronounce it?
Oh, Bergamo. Yeah, Bergamo. Yeah. I've been there. I used to do a lot of road races on this bike and everything, and one of them started in Bergamo. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember
– Beautiful area. That's where San Pellegrino water comes from.
Bergamo Alta. Yeah, the upper part of the city, which is – really gorgeous, yeah, definitely.
The old part, there's a finicky mm-hmm. That goes up to the old town of Bergamo. Yeah. It's a neat area, yeah.
I think in Bergamasca they say Bergen de Hola, something like that. You know? Uh-huh. They would speak this dialect like that. I didn't know what the fuck they were saying. Yeah. the guys would come along to me, and they'd say something in dialect. I go, "Sisi, whatever," you know. I just didn't understand what the hell they were saying. Yeah. Oh, what was it?
Now, are you fluent in Italian, Joe?
Can't even remember. Oh, anyway, it's been a while. But they all speak dialect. You know, when you go out cycling and you get out of the big cities, everyone starts speaking their local dialect. You know, I can understand Milanese dialect, but Bergamasco is a lot. It was much more difficult. You know.
Wow,
I didn't realize there was such a change
from the.
For instance, how could I say that? Oh gosh, chapasu kale mbiju. Okay, this means like reach up to her boobs because it's a jewel. Okay, in Italian it would.
I'm not sure what that means in English.
Prendi in alto perché è un gioiello. Okay, so it's quite different. That's Italian standard as opposed to beforehand that was Milanese, or you could say chapindre perché lei un bignè. Okay, that would be like grab her from behind because it's like a pastry. Okay,
all righty then.
I would learn all these things, and then my ex-wife's uncle was a policeman there, a city policeman. They called him Giza, okay, because the hat that they wore back in the day was like a sort of a. The hats that bobbies wear in the UK, okay? It was made out of Giza. It's not lead. It's something heavier, though, you know? And so they would call him a Giza, una Giza. And he would always speak to me. I remember when we'd go over to his house for dinner in dialect, you know, he says, and he would, you know, he'd say, "Chapa, John, chapa, you know, take this." And he goes, "Ti piace, no?" He said, "You don't like it?" And I'm thinking, I'm trying to learn Italian. This guy's rambling on in dialect, but I learned it, you know.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they don't have those phrases on Rosetta Stone.
No. You see, back in the day, I mean, these are Italians. Okay? Right. Let's not, never forget. Okay?
Absolutely. You know?
Italians are passionate and sensual.
Oh, no doubt. John, how did you end up going to university in Northern Italy?
No, I didn't go to university there. I went to UCLA.
Oh, okay. Okay. I misunderstood. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I just went to UCLA because my dad suggested it. He'd gone there for 3 years. And back in the day, it was really easy. It was just sort of an average of your SAT scores and your grade point average in high school. I sent them both. And I don't know, I did some essay on some stupid thing, and they let me in. It was back in the Stone Age. But anyway, that's a good university, you know. I mean, the UC system was, it was next to nothing when I was going there. You'd pay like $500 a trimester, okay?
Yeah.
Well, when my dad was going there in the 50s, it was free, you know. Huh. You just had to be a resident. To be a resident, you just said you were a resident. So just sign up, yeah? Yeah.
Yeah, I live right around the corner.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, come on, go to college.
Well, those were the days when you actually, you know, you bought a ticket for an airplane and you walked out and up the thing there with your bag and on you went, you know?
Yeah.
And you could give them any kind of name you wanted. Yeah, there was no checking this, checking that, and worried about whether you were a terrorist.
Travel has definitely changed.
So, John, where did you grow up? You're in Canada now. Did you grow up in Canada or California, or where did you grow up predominantly?
No. I was born in Miami, Florida, and raised there for the most part until I was about 17. with the exception of a few years. I think one was in Boston, one was in New York City, and one was in Connecticut. And then I finished high school in Connecticut at a boarding school that my dad had gone to. And then I went out to UCLA.
I have a question for you, John. Have you ever been to Bimini? You know where Bimini is?
Bimini. Tons of times. Are you kidding?
Right. Well, so
my parents used to take me there when I was a baby.
I can imagine, because on the seaplanes. I lived in South Florida for several years. I lived in Hutchinson Island, just a little bit north of West Palm Beach. Uh-huh. And a friend of mine took me to Bimini, and I had never – here I am from West Virginia, right? And it's, you can by plane, you can get to Bimini in 35 minutes, 3 hours by boat.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Right?
Sure.
So we got over there, and I can remember the first thing was they don't have desalinization plants, so you go to take a shower, and you open your mouth, and it's salt water. You're like, oh, well, that's
day,
not good, but okay.
True. That was true. I remember the pools had all salt water.
Right.
Okay. And water was kind of sort of precious. I think that they've changed that now.
It's been a long time.
A bit more. Yeah. I mean, they put a casino up there.
Oh, really?
In the northern part of the North Island.
A lot of Fort Lauderdale people would buy over there and build houses up on stilts.
There's that. Yeah. And then there's another development on the northern part of the Northern Island, which is basically run by a Cuban-American group.
Oh.
And most of the people who go to that skip Allistown completely. You know,
uh-huh.
Allistown was the old place, you know, where the seaplanes had come up there,
right,
and everything. And you go through customs with the picture of the queen there in the booth and stuff. It was crazy. But
I can remember
some of the best fishing in the world because you're perched right on the Gulf Stream. I mean, back in the day, you could catch anything there. Tuna, marlin. My grandfather was one of the founders of the IGFA. He was a good friend of Mike Lerner, who was the founder, and so he became my grandfather, the first vice president. But as an officer, he couldn't really declare any fish that he caught, okay, because that was one of the rules. And he, I believe at one point, there's a picture of him with a mako shark that he caught, and it was something like 750 pounds or something like that.
I saw that photo.
And it was a world record at the time, but it isn't attributed to him. I mean, it wasn't declared as valid because he was the vice president of the IGF. He was an officer.
Oh,
okay.
I remember all of the photos of your grandfather everywhere in Bimini, the End of the World Bar, right? Is that the name of that? Do you remember that?
Yeah. Did you get there before the Complete Angler burned down?
I can't remember. Let's see. This was probably around... This is probably before 9/11 in the States, so this was
before 2001. Oh, yeah. If you went there before 9/11, for sure it was there, because that thing burnt down, I think, in 2010 or thereabouts.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so it was there when
I
was there.
Now, that had been a hotel that was there since at least, I think, the 1930s. It was run by a British woman and her husband, and when he passed on, she was there for ages. And I remember going in there, and she would tell anyone who wasn't wearing a shirt to put on a shirt for dinner, you know. But you could go up to the bar, and even I could. I could order Bloody Marys if I wanted to. You know, I was a kid. It was just absolutely different, you know. And the rooms, my God. I remember once we were in this room where my dad said he had slept, you know, with his father at one point. And the thing was actually cold in the middle of the summer because of the insulation they had there. I don't know. It was really strange. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
Beautiful hotel. Too bad. They had a lot of historic pictures. Everything went up in smoke in this fire.
Oh, that's really terrible. I remember seeing pictures of your grandfather everywhere in Bimini. I thought he must have either... I thought he must have employed so many people or something because he was always fishing from there, right?
That
was right. So
there that long. He was there in the 1930s.
Okay.
And for a couple of summers, I think I'm not sure. Yeah, he was in the 1930s. Yeah, the 1930s. And I believe at that point he was already in Key West. Mm-hmm. So he was just, you know, tooling it from Key West out there.
Not far away. No. Not far away at all.
And he really liked it because, I mean, he was there. You have to understand that he actually, in part, created the whole sort of deep sea fishing boat, the whole idea. The Pilar had a transom which was lowered so that it'd be easier to haul the fish on. Outriggers was something that he helped create with along with someone else. He was constantly looking for a better fighting chair. And I remember once he had to go out to Hawaii for the IGFA to check on this new chair to make sure that it was regulation, that sort of stuff, you know. But he was there, and then he moved on, you know, to Cuba, and that's where he started doing a lot of his fishing.
Well, bringing up your grandfather, what is it like growing up Hemingway? I mean, I'm sure there's some burdens, but there's obviously great stories just like that of all the interesting things he's done. So what is that like growing up Hemingway?
Well, my dad always took me fishing. He himself once caught a 750-pound tuna off the coast of Cape Cod.
Wow.
And he was out there with Norman Mailer. Okay.
Wow. Oh, wow.
And Norman was totally drunk. Okay. And he kept sort of saying, oh, you're never going to catch him. You know, my dad had a fish on it. It took him 8 hours to bring it in. Okay. And he would say, oh, you're just not going to be like you. And he'd say, shut up, Norman. Okay, and then Norman would go over to the side of the boat and puke some more.
Sounds like a great fishing partner.
So is this from your memory or from a story? Were you there, John?
Yeah, I can just imagine that. I met him once before he died. He was a very, very interesting person. But that was – no, actually, we got both pretty drunk that night. I was so drunk that I was doing a documentary based on the book that I was writing, which then became the memoir of my father. And I was so out of it that they put me in a wheelchair to put me through customs on the way down to Miami. This is right after 9/11, you know, and I'm like, oh God, I felt like such shit. And they gave me this drink, sort of like a Gatorade on steroids or something that reconstituted all of my, you know, the nasty things that came out of me or whatever. And by the time I got to Key West, I was feeling like a million, you know, right? Normals could be.
Who is modern in medicine. Key West, right?
What's that?
Key West has that effect on people.
You're right.
It's a great town.
It is. We didn't talk much when you were down there. How long were you in Key West this time?
Ooh, I basically was there for, let's see, I got there on Sunday. We drove down from Fort Lauderdale. And then Monday I was basically doing everything I had to do. You know, it was a meet and greet and then a sort of a private party later on where I gave a presentation of Bacchanalia for the first time. That was interesting because I didn't know really what I was going to say, but it worked.
Did you do that at Pilar Rum?
Yeah. There in the distillery / interactive museum that they have.
Actually, Jim, you still have yours, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, we got it. We picked up a couple bottles ourselves when we were down there. What was that, 2 years ago? Last time we were down there?
Just a year and a half ago. It was last winter. The winter before last.
Yeah. No, John, can you tell us a little bit about the distillery, some of the history there, and how or if you're involved in any way?
Distillery, I remember they had bought, let's see, in 2014 perhaps they were building it. And it was inaugurated in 2017, and Christine and I were there for that. I gave a little speech, and a few other people did. And I'm not sure what it was used for beforehand. It might have been used for many things. It's a historic building in Key West. And you can tell because they've left a lot of the original bricks and things like that and everything. Really, they've done a beautiful job on it. And if anyone hasn't been there, it's great because you can taste the various versions of rum that they have there. You can go on a tour of it if you want to. There's a gift shop. It's a great place. Yeah.
Oh, we tasted it all. Yeah. And then we came back with a couple bottles.
And then they had to, put Tony on a wheelchair and take him to the airport.
I think, you know, that day I sold 63 copies of Bacchanalia. But more than that, I signed about 80 Papas Pilar bottles. So more people were buying bottles than books.
you're going to have to run a package deal.
I was going to say, you should put together a package deal, John.
He's a real Hemingway fan. So. Yes, we all talk about him because of his literature, but there's the drinking.
But. Yes, there is. Now, when you go to Key West, do you hit any of his old haunts? I know it was, even though it's Sloppy Joe's, it was Captain Tony's back then and that type of stuff. Is there any, do you have any favorites in Key West or anything that are tied back to?
I like the house. I was good friends at one point with the guy who was running it. Okay. But he's retired and I think he's spending most of his time up in Pennsylvania now. But Christina wanted to see where Tony's was. So I took her by it so she could have a look inside. She was like, ooh, that looks dark.
So he retired from Key West to Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Okay.
But because I don't know why, but
he lost a bet.
You know, it's funny because he grew up in the house which was right next to my grandfather's house. Oh, wow. You know? Okay. And so in fact his father, I think it was, or his grandfather. Now, his grandfather would argue with my grandfather. His grandfather was this old Cuban guy who was like, you know, what are you doing? Are you messing up my property? Because like, they were creating the wall around the house. You know?
And didn't they tear up the street or something to build the wall? Didn't they peel up the bricks from the street to build the wall around the house or something?
Yeah,
like that?
I think they got those cheap from the city itself. And so, yeah. It's interesting. I think everything is reused in Key West. You know, it's a fascinating place. It's so urban, and yet it's so small town. You know, mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is.
It
wild.
Is. It's neat.
You can definitely have some fun there.
Oh yeah, it's a drinking town. It's a party town. Yeah.
If you don't, you don't belong.
No, yeah. You don't belong. You're really? No friend of mine.
Yeah, right. You can't have fun in Key West.
Go north.
Yeah.
See ya.
Yeah. Well, John, do you have any trips planned coming up? Assuming you can take them.
Yeah, assuming I can take them. Well, my brother-in-law, Christina's brother, is getting married at the beginning of August. So I'm supposed to be there. I presume that by then it won't be much of a problem for me to get the visa to get
That's
over there.
That's where?
This is in St. Petersburg in Russia.
Oh, in Russia.
Nice.
Okay. Yeah. Now, I was planning on going to the Fiesta, but I don't know what the hell they're going to do. I don't think they'll cancel it. They'll find some way of keeping it going. And other than that, nothing really planned, you know.
I haven't really looked.
I was supposed to actually go down to Key West again on the 1st of May. But again, I don't know what the hell the situation is going to be like, you know, whether.
Where you're flying from.
But from one day to the next, I'm just get all these different sort of reports about this or that or whatever. This is really a weird period we're going through.
It is. We were just talking. We were supposed to be in Vegas for a convention.
Yeah, travel conference.
In, what, 3 weeks?
April 4th through the 7th.
They haven't canceled it yet, which shocks me.
Right.
Yeah. And then I'm supposed to be in Orlando in May, so who knows?
I was supposed to be in Italy in
That's
May.
That's right.
Oh, God.
I was supposed to take 9 other family members, and I've been planning a trip for a while now and had to cancel it. I have to cancel
That's
everything.
Crazy. Absolutely crazy. So, John, you were mentioning you got the new novel coming up. You want to give a little bit more insight into any of that at this point and any ideas of when you think it might be out?
Well, I've got to write it first. I'm really at the beginning. Okay. I've been talking to a friend of mine, an editor at Thomas Dunn, and I explained to him that, you know, this starts out in the summer, okay, when – this character, David Cazzati. He's a sort of an Italian American from Miami, because his parents were both Italian, moved there. Okay, and so he remembers just in flashes. Okay, because his parents took him there when he was a kid. He's pretty much, I would say, right now in his late 20s or something like that, you know. And he's decided to quit selling insurance, you know, to get out of that scam, as he calls it, and to see the world or something like that. And what he does is he finds work with a language school. And his plane, I think, was to Zurich, and then he took a train down. And then someone from the school comes to meet him. It's a young lady, looking quite nice in the heat, because it's really hot, just totally. Milano in the summer can be, you know, the kind of sort of beastly hot, you know, hot and humid and everything. And she introduces herself and everything, and they kind of like it each other. And, you know, and she shows him to the apartment that they've rented to him and everything. And he'd like to go out with her that night, but she's kind of busy. Fine, well, we'll meet the next night. Okay. So he says he's got the day to himself, and he takes off, and he goes downtown, and he sees the Duomo, the cathedral, and the Galleria Vittorio Emanuele. These are things from like the 1800s, beautiful. And as he's, they had this bull there, okay? And if legend has it that on New Year's Eve, if you do a sort of a pirouette with your heel on the bull's balls, okay, and you'll have good luck, mm-hmm. Okay?
I've done that.
Yeah, so he does that, and as he stops, okay, there's this other woman there, okay? Not a blonde, but a sort of a brunette. I don't know if you've ever, what was that woman? There was a sort of a cartoon series of this, this photographer, blonde, leggy-looking woman with a short sort of page cut, okay? And he says, oh, my God, she looks a lot like her, okay? And he finds out, and she says, well, can I take a picture, you know, if you want, you know? And so she does. He finds out she's studying photography at the Accademia di Brera, okay? It's a sort of an art academy in the Brera area. And they decide, she says, look, I can, you know, if you've got nothing better to do, I can kill some time for you, because he says he's trying to sort of beat the jet lag and stay up as late as he can, you know. So she takes him down to the Naviglio, and they go to one of her favorite bars, and they start drinking and everything, and he thinks he's going to get a drunk, but in fact, he's the one who starts feeling sloshed, okay? So she basically carries him, you know, not carries him, but, you know, he's got his arm over his shoulder, and she's helping him walk to her apartment, okay? And they get up there, and the next thing you know, they start making love, and then they fall asleep, you know, it's 3 a.m, whatever. And in the morning, he leaves her a note saying that he'll call her, okay? And he didn't want to wake her. And as soon as he gets out, he remembers that he's supposed to call the other girl, but instead he sends her a text saying, you know, are we still on today? And she goes, yes, where are you? And he tells her, oh, I'm at the Duomo, which was a lie because he was down by the Naviglio, but he thought it better not to sort of, you know, reveal that, okay? And so I'm at that point right there. Mm. Where he thinks, I can actually read you a little bit of it. This is an anteprima. Okay, here we go.
Ooh, a little preview. Yeah, like please.
Yeah. Okay. So, where are you? She wrote back. Near the Duomo, he told her, which he obviously knew wasn't true, but for some reason he thought it was better to keep his true location a secret. Okay, she wrote. Well, yes or no, he asked. Of course. Your place or mine? Yours, she told him. At 7? Alle sette, she texted, which is at 7 in Italian. He put his phone down and finished his coffee and his croissant, thinking that this situation, that is, having already gone to bed with one woman since his arrival in Milan, and with the odds better than average that he would sleep with yet another tonight, was somewhat usual, for him at least. He had never thought of himself as a Don Giovanni, but then, was it his fault that they kept hitting on him? None whatsoever. He remembered Daniele's question about expressing himself in a powerful and symbolic way, and he'd come up with a theory that Italy was the one place on the planet, if indeed such a country existed, that could bring out this power and sensuality in anyone. It was simple. All you had to do was accept the ground rules of the Bel Paese and acknowledge in your mind and in your heart that beauty and love ruled in this neck of the world. Of course, as soon as he thought this, the American in him protested. Merit and hard work, it said, were as important, if not more important, than passion or beauty. But after his night with Daniele, he knew which side to believe. From the bar, he walked to Porto Genova, where he took the green line of the subway to Stazione Cadorna, then switched to the red line and got off at Porto Venezia.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You have to finish this book.
I was going to say, can you get to work now?
Yeah. I say that.
I think you're
just leave, John. Go.
I think you're well qualified to handle the audiobook. That was well read.
Yeah.
Yeah, we might have a trip to Milano.
I did a lot of public speaking over the years, but
I told my friends that story of me doing the pirouette on the testicles of the
you did it too.
I did that, and they didn't believe me. Thank you, John, for clearing that up, because they didn't believe
me. It's true. We used to always do that. On New Year's Eve, we go out there, you know, and everyone would have to do their pirouette, okay? And it, as you can tell, you know, they probably fix it every now and then, but they basically wear off the tiles there.
Right, it is worn down.
Poor bull's balls, you know?
Thank you for clarifying that, John.
We still don't believe you, Eric.
We believe John. We just don't believe you.
Friends, who needs them, right?
That's awesome, though.
So, John, how about your other book, the memoir, Strange Tribe? Is that something that you can tell us a little bit about?
Strange Tribe was written over a period of about 3 years. And I was under a lot of pressure when I wrote that. I mean, I'm always under pressure as I'm writing. But this thing, I was dealing with, you know, real people. And what's more, I was talking about my father. And to understand my father, you had to understand a bit more about his relationship with his father, Ernest Hemingway. Now, I don't know how many thousands of books have been written by various scholars and people about my grandfather, but I knew that if I didn't get this right, I'd be nailed to the cross. Yeah. You know? So it was that kind of thing. I mean, I was, and you say why? Well, Strange Tribe, it's called Strange Tribe because, my father cross-dressed from when he was a teenager. And there is the story, which he told to a journalist once, actually, about the first time that Ernest ever saw him, you know, in a pair of nylons. He was putting on, one of Mary's pairs or something like that, you know. And he was about 12 years old or thereabouts. And Ernest walked in, saw him, you know, and according to my dad, he says there was just this look on his face like, oh, my God, you know, him too, instead of all this thing. This is what my dad thought, but Ernest didn't say anything. You know, he just saw him, walked out, okay. And then a few days later, when they were at the pool there at the Finca Vigia, and just outside of Havana, which is where his house was, he said to my dad, "Gigi," that was his nickname, "you and I come from a very strange tribe." And that was all he said.
Interesting.
And my dad was like, you know, nothing else, you know, no, like, maybe you need to see a therapist or something like that, you know, right. Just this elliptical shit, he called it, you know. And so I took that as the title, Strange Tribe, you know, and basically, you know, when I was growing up with my dad, okay, he was bipolar, he was always having, you know, breakdowns and things like that. And eventually I found out that he was also cross-dressing, all right? And I tended to sort of put a barrier between my dad and my grandfather because, you know, well, Ernest is Ernest, man's man, everything else, okay? At the same time, you know that, I mean, these people are father and son, and the, you know, Greg didn't just appear out of the Black Lagoon, you know, he had a past. And I started the book out with the idea that there would be this barrier, but then I reached a point where I couldn't do anything. And then I started looking at the scholarship, avant-garde scholarship amongst Hemingway scholars, especially after the publication of, what was that thing called there? The one that came out in about 1986. It was a posthumous novel. And what am I thinking, Tender is Night? That's his buddy's book. No. This is called The Garden of Eden. Yes, there we go. And in The Garden of Eden, you've got this young writer who is just coming off his first major success, and he's down with his wife in the southern part of France, and they are heavily into gender bending and getting deeply tanned. Now, you know, if you didn't know Ernest, you might think, well, okay, so what? So they're getting deeply tanned in the south of France. But deeply tanned, as I discovered also from letters between my father and my grandfather, symbolized for Ernest going beyond all tribal law. In short, becoming separated from the Judeo-Christian ethic and becoming more African. And so tanning, wherever you hear it, and there's another short story called A Sea Change, where this man is breaking up with his girlfriend because she wants to have a lesbian relationship. And they are both deeply tanned because they are going beyond all tribal law. And at the end, when his girlfriend walks out with the other girl, he's at the bar and he sees a gay couple, you know, at the other end there. And he says to himself, and this has been crossed out of the final version, but I could find it in the Kennedy Library, and the manuscripts. And it says, well, maybe everyone's like that. Yeah. And so there's all this sort of stuff. And I was making connections. You know, I started reading these books, okay, which talked about, talked about his Hemingway's fetishes. For instance, it was Carl Eby talking about that, you know, his hair fetish with red hair, how he, this hilarious letter once where he tried to dye his hair, okay, blonde to be like, to please his wife, but instead it turned out red, a dark, deep red, okay? And he was fucking scared shitless. What am I going to do now, you know? And it reminded me so much of my father, who would do the crazy things and just like sort of panic and then sort of say, oh, well, who cares, you know?
In the end,
they were very much alike. You know, they were very intense people, very, very emotional, and they needed each other. They loved each other, but at times it was impossible for them to talk to each other because of the way that they were. Ernest suffered from clinical depression. He called them black ass periods. And so did his father. And my father was bipolar, although in the beginning they didn't call it that. They called it paranoid schizophrenia and stuff like that. And he would have shock treatments in the 1950s because that was the only thing they could do to stop it, you know, to put a reset button, you know, on the depression. Because he would go through a manic phase and fall into, you know, deep clinical depression. And this would happen almost cyclically at times, you know. And the letters between these two, the letters, my God.
Imagine.
You know, there were times when I was like reading them and I'd say, I want to help them both. And I'd say, no, they're dead, John. There's nothing you can do. You know, I'm what's left, so to speak, or my kids, you know, with the DNA and everything. And you look at this. So I said, no, I got to do this right. You know, I said, I got to get my dad. Because I won't tell you the whole book, you know, but it's a tragedy.
You had a tough time with this one. Was this something that you chose to do, or were you approached?
Every time I talk about it in public, you know, it's not something that they say, oh, this must be cathartic for you, Mr. Hemingway. And I said, no, it isn't. This is not something that changes. You know, it's something that I live with, that I talk about to people, because I've met many people over the years that I've been speaking about this who are bipolar, or whose boyfriend or husband or girlfriend is bipolar or whatever, you know. And I know, you know, this helps people deal with it. And because the book basically is not so much about Ernest Hemingway and being a great author and everything, but this is about family and fathers who, for instance, like Ernest, could see what was happening to his son, that he knew that this came from him, but there wasn't a damn thing he could do. And I would try to think about that at times. I'd say, how would you feel that way, John? You know, if you were in that situation. And Ernest, I have to admit, was a good father, you know, as much as he could be, for as long as he could be, you know.
No, that's pretty amazing. I'm looking forward
good,
to reading
good
that.
Good insight. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that.
Yeah,
I appreciate that.
No problem.
Well, cool.
Anything else that maybe you've got coming up that you want to chat about a little bit?
Well, I told you I read you a piece from this book. That's what I'm doing there. That'll keep me busy for the next couple of months for sure. Probably the next half a year, I would imagine, but at least.
The world is an unknown right now, mm-hmm. and where we're going and what we're doing, right?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just gone nuts.
More
we
so
can,
than usual.
We can plan, but we can plan right. to cancel, I guess.
Plan for the chaos.
Plan for the chaos.
Yeah.
Well, John, you have to keep us updated if you guys end up getting your visa and head over to Pamplona.
For sure. Yeah,
because yeah. We're still not 100% sure where the hell we're going to be either, but we're going to try to go. We missed, I guess,
I think,
the years you were there.
I don't think anyone knows what's going to happen these days. It's like all certainty has disappeared.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So. Yeah, we need to get back. We definitely want to get back, so that's the goal, but who knows?
Yeah, we missed last year, so we're hoping to get back. So, and then also, we'll have to check in with you occasionally here and see how you're going on the book, and absolutely when you get the next one out, we're going to...
Oh, I'm looking forward to writing that one too, because I had another character in that one. The protagonist was also called Hector. I didn't realize that I repeated the same name, you know. But this guy's Cuban, and he's like, he was a member of the ruling family, as I called it. Okay, but he just like can't stand the regime, and is so sick and tired of the lies and everything else, and makes it a point of driving a car, you know. Which is, you know, decadent and bourgeois, an Italian Alfa Romeo from the 1950s, but it was a special edition or something like that. And he's driving like crazy. And, of course, none of the cops stop him because they know who he is, you know. And, yeah, and he just takes out this American from Texan who wants to sort of do business there. And they all get rip-roaring drunk. And he knows what the Texan is there for, you know. And he knows that, in a way... The Texan wants to sort of, you know, conquer, you know, Cuba or something like that. But this guy isn't going to let him do that, so to speak. It's, that one, I called it Patria o Muerte. The country or death.
We're looking forward
like
to
that. Yeah. Sure. So like one of these, you know, revolutionary... sayings they have plastered all over the sort of billboards as you're going in and out of Havana. Sort of stuff. Yeah.
Well, that's.
Yeah, there's also in that short story, there's a little sort of a story within a story of this young doctor friend of the protagonist who's really a good. I mean, the Cubans do incredible research, you know, biomedical research and everything. This guy was one of those types, okay? But he also liked windsurfing. And at one point, he was out on his windsurfing thingy, and he realized that he was too far out to get back in before dark. And so, with just the keys to his house and his bathing suit pocket, he decides to continue towards Key West. Mm. And he ends up in the key, which is just below it, in the early morning.
Wow.
This actually happened, you know. And in the morning, it was, you know, wet foot, dry foot sort of thing like that. And he managed to obviously set foot on the island, and they gave him asylum. That was before they got rid of it. But there's also that there. So that's going to be another thing. You know, this guy will then go to Miami, okay? And then there'll be sort of a back and forth between the Cuban community in Miami and the Cuban community in Havana, which is... in a sense, kind of two different worlds, but they aren't. They're both Cuban. It's very weird. You know?
Have you ever tried to windsurf, John?
Once.
It's hard. It's difficult.
It was in I was living with my grandfather's brother, Lester Hemingway, at their house on the tip of San Marino Island between Miami and Miami Beach. And this guy had a windsurf, and so he let me try it. I think I just basically fell into the water a couple of times.
Oh, it's not easy.
I love sailing, okay? But this was just like, no, this is a bit different.
It is not easy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I tried once, and it's all I need to do.
Yeah, it's not easy. I've tried to surf, too, and it's not easy. But even windsurfing, it was even more difficult than surfing. It was weird. Like you said, John, you fell right over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. Oh, well.
Very nice. Well, John, we have to give you a big shout out and thank you for joining us today. Obviously, we want to do a shout out for your books, Bacchanalia, which you can get on Amazon.com. Do you have a website or anything you want to promote at this point?
You just go to – no, I'd say just go – I do have a blog, but I'm hardly ever writing on it. So – if you want either of the books, you can get them both on Amazon. Because I got the rights came back to me after a while. This stupid editor tried to sort of screw me on this, and so they all came back to me. So I put it out in Strange Tribe is also in paperback and in Kindle, along with Bacchanalia. And just look up my name, and you'll find. Either book there. Yeah.
Awesome.
Great. Well, fantastic. Once again, a big thank you for joining us today on the Friends of Carry On podcast. And as we close it out, for our listeners, if you want to follow us, you can find us at friendsofcarryon.com or on the social medias, Facebook, Instagram, here soon, YouTube at friendsofcarryon.com. Anyhow, thanks for listening. Appreciate it.
Thanks, John. Look forward to having you back again.
Hey, thanks to you guys.
And arrivederci.
Be sure to join the friends next week for another great discussion. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. You can also find the friends and other content at www.friendsatcarryon.com or check us out on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook by searching Friends at Carry On. Thanks again for joining us, and don't forget to carry on, friends.